Hello there, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 127, or something like that. Johnny is still in the Dagobah system, or wherever it is that he is over the holidays.
Alabama.
Searching for something.
Sweet home Alabama.
Yes, yes he is. but we do have, and John is also on family business. It is that time of the year, season's greetings everybody. This is your host,
in Canada.
Your interim host, Greg. Joined by master of all things interim, James Jones.
Thanks.
Yeah, he was interim features editor and community
I was interim community manager.
Yeah, you were interim features editor until you were the features editor.
Yes, which essentially just means disrespect or dump on me whenever you get the opportunity when you're a community manager.
Yeah.
I'm going to ban you. Have they turned on your ban powers?
No.
Maybe.
Yeah, well, but we have two very special guests. I'm first of all very, very pleased to have back on the show for the first time in several months, I think, since the summer, from Okinawa to Japan. It's Michael TYP.
Hello, everybody. Hi, Dr. Nick.
I'm very, very pleased. I hope everyone's been listening to Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, of course.
Of course.
Which has been going strong since the move to Okinawa, and it's on iTunes now.
I don't know if you could say going strong. You've been doing it like every 3 weeks.
Yeah, I'm willing to call it that. Don't worry.
Okay. There have been strong episodes.
Oh, thank you.
Exactly. I'm willing to call it that, and like it's on iTunes now, so
that's right.
No excuse for not finding it. Get on there, review it, love it, enjoy it, all that good stuff. And it's just good to have you back on Radio Free Nintendo, though, because like I said, it's been a while. I think it was back when they announced WarioLand Shake It. Funnily enough,
yeah, I was like, I don't know, man, it may be bad. Yeah,
yeah, well, there's innocent summer days. Know. Yeah, but yeah, good
conditioned response.
Well, we'll talk more about that later. So.
We will, yes. We will. But we
save it for the show.
Hey, yeah. That's my catchphrase! Hey!
Or the pertinent part of the show, but that really isn't a catchphrase. But we also have another very special guest making his second appearance on the show, James Charlton from Japan. He was stationed in Japan for us, our man on the ground.
Ahoy, ahoy. I'm on the mainland. I'm on the real Japan.
Yeah, I'm in America, Japan.
not the fake Hawaii / Japan that TYP is at.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Very nice.
Fair enough. Not supposed to accept that.
Well, he's been there a few months, so I assume he's not like applying for citizenship or something.
He hates it already.
So we'll get cracking then with new business and...
Good job.
TYP, you go first.
Okay, well, over the last few weeks, I've been playing a couple of things. First off... when I bought my new TV when I first got here, every store here has like loyalty points. It's just something that they do in Japan. And since I bought a TV, which was like $400, I got quite a few points. And so with those points, I bought Owenden 2 for the DS.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so... Nice.
Which we just talked about, actually, amazingly enough.
And, very briefly, yeah.
Yeah, and I've only played it a little. The copy I had already had all the songs unlocked, so I've just sort of been picking away at it here and there. Playing it, I like it, but I can see why they changed the song lineup for Leap Beat Agents for the original, because there are a couple of songs I enjoy in Owenden 2, and it's neat and all, but I can't get into a lot of the Japanese songs in the soundtrack, so... I don't know, maybe it's just me, but...
TYP, can I ask, like, the only two songs that you like, are they the only two, like, non-Japanese songs?
No, I recognized one from, like, an anime or something I'd watched. I don't remember which song. I really haven't played it that much, but I was playing it on the bus and things, you know, I'm not playing my DS all that much right now, so... So I thought I'd give a shout out. It is fun. I mean, if you're starved for more EVA action, it's a really good choice.
Sure. I mean, it's still fundamentally the same game, right? It's just it's purely the song list.
Yeah, I mean, if it's, you know, if you like J-pop and stuff like that, then definitely get it. Well, I mean, they have more than just J-pop, but yeah, I mean, that's why I'm kind of lukewarm on it. I mean, it plays fine, but some of the songs I just can't get into. Let's see, what else? Everyone who has been listening to me for a while knows that I'm kind of fed up with Mega Man and don't like it anymore. But I decided to give Mega Man 2 a shot because everyone keeps saying it's the best one. So I downloaded it for Virtual Console a few weeks ago.
And I hate it.
No, actually, I'm enjoying it. I'm definitely convinced I don't want to play Mega Man 9, though, because this is plenty hard for me. I do not want Mega Man 9. I know I don't want Mega Man 9.
Is Mega Man 9 meant to be appreciably harder than 2, or is it meant to be about the same? Cause...
See, I don't understand why people complain about his games being hard.
Well, it's perfect for me. I really love
Mega
Man 9.
I think it's an issue where I spent my childhood playing these games, so I sort of became conditioned.
Right.
Yeah, I'd go along with that for myself, too.
I mean, I played first Mega Man when I was like 4 or 5, and then just kept abusing myself. Which sounds
dirty. Dear me.
not related to Mega Man.
Yeah.
Just you abused yourself.
For the next 18 years. So I guess it's hard for me to gauge, but I would say that their goal was to make a game hard, because if you think about it, way back when, part of the goal was to make a game so hard, friends would go talk to their friends, I can't beat this game! Well, I'm going to make him look bad, and they'd go buy the game themselves. So I think part of that's there now.
And of course, it's rooted in the whole arcade.
The arcade,
philosophy.
Where I'm going to take all your quarters.
Even games that weren't for the arcade sort of
like
inherited that design. Yeah, and Castlevania also, I would say, inherited the sort of trappings of the game design philosophy of the time.
And that's why I really don't like the original Castlevania games. I just can't get into them because I don't like that design. I mean, I grew up on Mario, and Mario doesn't have that mentality, really. I mean, it doesn't.
No, I mean, there's plenty of ability to die in the original Super Mario Bros.
Sure.
Especially
absolutely.
Some of the Bowser castles. But yeah, I appreciate it. It's not quite so sort of cynical, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
And I guess it's interesting with Castlevania, because in Japan, that was a Famicom Disk System game, which meant you could save it. It kind of made more sense that it'd be really hard, because if you can save something, it wouldn't last very long unless it was very, very difficult. But of course,
it was long.
And it's not very long for the. So I guess that the thing is, the US market kind of got stiffed on that in terms of they got a game that seemed much harder than perhaps it should do. Because it was designed with the intent that you'd be able to save it, and I assume Mega Man did that have saves like in any region or any time in the old days?
Well, doesn't it have a password
it
screen?
Passwords,
yeah,
right?
It has a password screen.
Does it have password? I didn't play any of them, so
I
have no idea.
A password.
Yeah, they have the 9x9 password grid.
Oh, okay. That's
now
fun.
Later games did have saves, but they kept the password grid because Capcom's a weird company.
Clinging to the past.
So even. I don't know if the Mega Man Zero games had them, but the Mega Man X games had the password grid, even though, I mean, in some cases they were on, like, PlayStation systems, where there was a memory card.
And they still had it?
They still had it, yeah.
Committed.
It was sort of a way of... It gave you the ability to sort of download cheats from the internet, too, though, because you could say, okay, well, what's the code for having everything awesome? And you could just go look at it.
Yeah, I guess that
makes sense.
Yeah, so anything else, TYP?
Yes,
from your...
the big game that I've been playing is Tales of Symphonia, Dawn of the New World for the Wii, which is the sequel to Tales of Symphonia for the GameCube. And I've had it for a couple of weeks now. I'd say I've put in maybe 20 or 25 hours. And, I mean, it's a good game. In many ways, it's very similar to the previous one. I was thinking of playing the original again. I brought it with me to Japan, and then I realized... Oh wait, the sequel's coming out in 6 months. I'll just wait for that. And I'm glad I did, because honestly, it's a little redundant, more so than I had expected. A lot of the areas you visit are the same, just like 2 years later. In fact, you even wind up going through a lot of the same dungeons, which is really weird. I think the puzzles are slightly different, but I don't know.
Making it on the
cheap,
huh?
I mean the dungeons are not the strong point. They weren't of the original either. There are too many switch puzzles, too many block puzzles. But, you know, the battle system's still fun. It's a little confusing. They've introduced this monster system where essentially it allows you to choose who you want to be supporting characters. And you know, they level up and you can change their class. And it works okay, but it's really kind of confusing how you go about capturing monsters. It has something to do with these elemental affiliations of the grid, and honestly, the game, the worst thing about this game is its horrible introduction and tutorial system. Frankly, the first 2 hours of the game are easily the worst in the game. It's really sad because I'm sure a lot of people are going to be turned off, and The problem is, well, it's twofold, really. First off, the voice acting is really annoying in the first 2 hours because although most of the voice acting is pretty good in the game, the main character is really whiny and annoying. And it's...
just like the original.
I don't remember that for Lloyd, but...
He wasn't so much whiny as he was, like, demanding and almost jerkish.
Okay, well... All right, there's a little bit of that too, I guess. But he's whiny, and it's really forced in the very beginning. I mean, really forced. And that is added on top of this tutorial system, which like handholds you for the wrong things. Like you spend 2 hours, very scripted battles in sequences where they're telling you how to do basics like run around the grid and use a basic attack, which right. If you've played a previous Tales game, you know. But
press A.
Well, no, it's a little more complicated than that. I mean, you have to set your hearts. Right? But
do you want me to repeat that?
Press A.
Well, but then they have these really quick explanations of these really confusing aspects of, you know, monster collecting and you know the elemental affiliations, which is sort of like, what, huh? You know, what did you say? So you spend 2 hours with this, and in the first 2 hours, the annoying kid flashes back in his memory to the same dialogue you've already heard in-game about 4 or 5 times. It's like, you know, it's like someone says something really important to him, and he flashes back to remember it like 5 times. And it literally it flashes
it happened 10
back.
Minutes ago.
Says, yeah, exactly. Like, I just heard this. Why are you doing this to me? And I was really pissed off at this dang. Game. But I talked to Wendy, who's reviewing the game, and hopefully it'll be up shortly. And he's like, yeah, it gets a little better. So... most of the voice acting is okay. It gets better. All in all, it's pretty good voice acting. But there are little things that annoy me. For example, I feel like the game is trying too hard to be Bleach. And what I mean by that is the main character is the whiny little boy kind of develops a split personality due to his making a pact with the Lord of Monsters.
Devil?
Not the devil. Well, sort of, maybe. We don't know. All right. I don't know yet.
Probably was the devil in the original Japanese.
Maybe. Who knows? But but the point is, when he's sort of possessed by his angsty side, so to speak, they have the same voice as the guy who does Ichigo from Bleach in the U.S. And quite possibly in the Japanese version, they have the same voice actor, too.
But by the way, that guy used to be the Black Power Ranger.
Sweet.
Awesome.
He was like the second Black Power Ranger.
Okay, yeah.
I really hope when
the Asian guy.
I really hope when you're talking about someone's evil, you know, so someone sort of being corrupted by some sort of evil force, that it is more potent than just like Spider-Man 3, where he acts kind of like a dick.
I think that's
movie.
Kind of where this is. He's sort of not like a bad person necessarily. He's just sort of a jerk.
Yeah. He's not so much evil as is he kind of like trips people as they walk by.
He's just got an attitude.
Asshole.
And, he's occasionally discourteous. This is what the Lord of Monsters does to
he
people.
Okay, okay, the he's... door for you when you come in.
He only tips 5%.
Okay, sometimes he's actually more violent than he should be, so maybe it's a little worse. I don't know. But building on top of this, they have this sidekick character that's this black cat who talks, and... familiar with the Bleach series, there's also a black cat that talks, and at least in the English version, it's the same voice actor doing the black cat.
Really?
As the black cat in the US local. And like I said, I wouldn't be surprised if that was also in the Japanese version. I just sort of get that feeling that in some ways it's trying to knock off or kind of steal from this other series. And I asked this creator, like, why are you doing this? Are you that... You know, are you not confident in your own Tales series? You've made so many of them, you know? Why do you have to, like, feel the need to pseudo-plagiarize? I don't get it. But and I'm still enjoying it. I think the story is actually better so far than in the first one. I'm enjoying it. It's a little less forced. And they also kind of adopt a system a little bit like Final Fantasy IV, where characters kind of weave in and out of your party. Your two main characters, Emil and the psychic character Marta, the kind of the love interest and healer, those are your only two real main characters. And you have these monsters that can fill in your party, and also characters from the original Tales of Symphonia weave in and out as the story progresses. And so you can play with those too. And I kind of like that. It's kind of neat. And I think it's a little more dynamic than in the original, where it's sort of just they built and for the most part, you kept those same characters throughout the game. I know they did it a little in the original, but it seems more pronounced in this game.
If that's all you've got, I know that was nice to get a bit of Tales discussion in, because we actually had a listener mail request to discuss the Tales series that we haven't been able to get in for now. So hopefully that will suffice at least for the time being.
So I've stolen the show for a while. That's all I really had to say. So who's next?
So we're James Charlton, as I may have to refer to you for the rest of the show.
That's right.
Hey, Charlie.
James.
Would you like to take it away with your...
TYP, I actually played that Tales game at the Tokyo Game Show.
And I hated it.
And, the demo that they had must have been like the worst part to show. I think the bit that you were talking about the tutorial.
Yes.
That was the whole Tokyo Game Show demo.
Yes!
So I was just sat there pressing A and just like staring at text, and I'm like, can I just play this game?
Yeah. You know, I have to wonder how much that like has hurt the overall scores for reviews. I mean, I don't know how many reviewers play through games enough. I mean, so I imagine there's some that play maybe 10 hours and then say, okay, I've played enough.
Johnny.
And so if the first two hours are the worst part of the game by far, it's a bad move, guys.
The first 10 minutes.
I spent an hour going through that shit. Okay.
Yeah, it's a tough line to walk, I suppose, when you're trying to sort of where you have to respect the fact that there's people have played the game before, you know, well, played the series before rather, and therefore, but obviously there'll be people who haven't. So it's kind of walking a fine line to do a good tutorial that can kind of accommodate both camps without annoying them in some way, but. It doesn't sound like they've managed that.
No, they didn't.
Tricky balancing act.
I mean, they have this kind of electronic dictionary or encyclopedia of terms and abilities, but...
Oh, boy.
But yeah, I mean, it doesn't help that much, and I think you still...
That sounds like fun.
You don't need to.
When you have to have an electronic dictionary of abilities, game might have gone a little too far. Might be time to dial it back a little bit.
Especially if it's available separately as a separate device that comes with the game.
It's a manual, yes.
Then
it's a manual.
Time to start firing games.
There is a manual as well, yes.
So, Mr. Charlton, is there anything you've been playing contemporaneously?
Nothing that new, unfortunately. My first is Guitar Cramp Hero.
Oh yes, right, the DS, one of the DS ones, I assume. How's that going for you, other than giving you carpal tunnel or whatever?
It's one of the few games. It's one of the few games that makes you disabled in two or more, possibly more ways. When
it
you
does.
Play it.
It's amazing. Both your wrists shot. Fingers on your left hand.
Your wrist is basically like, you know, disabled from like your wrist down. You can't use your hands or fingers for like at least 3 hours after playing the game.
Oh, they're shot. That's your left hand.
Yeah, yeah, and your eyes like. I had trouble focusing for, like, you know, at least half an hour after playing the game.
Yeah, they're out.
Put it this way, you couldn't drive after playing this game for
and your right
hours.
Wrist. Remember, right wrist also issues from the little thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right. Both wrists. Yeah,
yeah, both wrists are shot, but in different ways.
No, Jesus.
One shot in the whole, like, strumming way, and the other one's, like, from the wrist down is just inoperable.
That's right.
So is
but,
it
but before you... Before this turns into like a rant about it, I was about to say I actually like it.
Yeah, so I guess it
has that effect on people.
Has to do quite well to overcome some of these debilitating physical conditions. So what is it
exactly?
Is it just like how well it replicates the experience on a handheld?
I haven't owned a real Guitar Hero game before. I've just played it, brief periods of time. It's quite hard to really. There's no real demo units in Japan. You know, or like, I don't know anyone with it. It's not a very popular game here in Japan. But, every time I see people playing it, I'm just like, that looks so freaking hard. I don't think I can do that. Like, with the five buttons, you know? So I thought, like, if they've reduced it to four buttons and it looks a bit easier, I thought this would be a good introduction to Guitar Hero. And it is. And I really like it. It's not too hard. I mean, for me, medium is really hard for me. I know people are probably like shouting at their iPods, calling me some kind of lame.
Yeah, I don't own Guitar Hero, but I can do a decent job in most songs in medium from my experience. But
Yeah, okay. I don't know whether the scale is different on the DS sort of one.
That's true.
It's probably easier.
Yeah, you never know. There's some curious.
The game gets kind of brutal in the last one, but before that,
who has played like the real Guitar Hero games?
Well, I've played them, but I haven't owned one.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Like on the DS version, like the easy setting only uses three buttons.
It's the same way on the consoles, isn't it?
Well, that's not true, because on Rock Band, there's the very easy setting where there's no buttons.
Yeah, where it's just kind of like...
what do you do?
You just riff.
Well, no, it's just kind of like the party mode, great. Isn't it? You know, I mean, if you've got a bunch of friends and family over and you just want to sort of muck around to the music, like more like play acting or karaoke than like playing a game.
You mean Wii Music?
Well, there's no karaoke element in Wii Music. but you know what I mean. It's just to like put it on that, and then you know everybody can have a laugh with it without being...
I don't know. I can imagine people singing along to Twinkle Twinkle Little Star when they're doing it.
Yeah, if you
while
want
somebody's
to,
playing it and dog barks.
It's not built into...
Even your pets can join in.
Yeah, he really is very inclusive.
So anyway, I like Guitar Hero DS despite it being, you know, wrist-crampingly awful. It's still good. Sure. So
wrist-crampingly awful.
In spite of it being awful, it's good.
That's going on the back of the box right there. Wrist-crampingly awful.
So
it's physically painful.
That could work as a box quote. So good you'll want to do yourself physical harm.
But then they'd be paraphrasing, and then it doesn't work.
So my next game, I picked up I think this is a launch title for the DS. I think it's a launch title. It was in Japan. Sawaru Made in Wario. Which is
WarioWare
Touched, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Was that a launch title?
It was like 2 weeks later, wasn't it?
Very early. It was in that
right because Feel the Magic had the show themselves for like a month.
Yeah, and I pathetically bought that game and I played it for about an hour before I said this sucks, and it's been rotting in my.
I got the sequel. That was awesome. Rubbing Rabbits. What was it called?
Yes, Rub Rabbits.
Rub the Rabbits.
Yes.
Rub your rabbit. I forgot.
Right. So yeah, you've gone back and played WarioWare Touched. Have you played a lot of the other WarioWare games before?
Yeah. I love Wario. Apart from the Wii one, I don't have the Wii one, but I've got all the other ones.
All right,
and
because
it was ridiculously cheap, I got it for like 1,000 yen, which is like about £5 or $10.
Well, how do you think it stacks up against the others in the series?
It's probably not as good as the GBA version.
The original
GBA version, okay. But I think it's pretty good. They've tried to cram a lot in. They've got a lot of, I like the menu system and like the little extras that they put in. It's obvious that it's partially a tech demo for the DS.
Yeah, I mean, it's
which
a very,
seems kind
I mean,
of
that's
weird
the thing.
When
I mean,
it's like,
I guess the thing with WarioWare, it's very natural though, isn't it? Relatively, you know, it's.
Yeah.
To do all these little applications of touchscreen stuff. It still would have presumably been sort of more amusing and impactful if you were playing it at launch. I guess that's right.
It's weird to play a tech demo when it's like the DS has been out for how many years now?
Four years. Yeah.
Is it 4 years? Yeah. So to play it now, it still stands up, and I think it's a good game, and I'm having fun trying to beat all the. Like get all the red ribbon things on each of the games. It's pretty cool. My favorite by far is the one where Wario is running up a nasal passage, and you have to like duck,
oh yeah,
avoids like snot, and then like it's kind of hard to explain. But
it's my day to day activities, to be honest.
That's something I would want to do.
And then,
I mean, why wouldn't you? I mean,
climb up a giant nasal passage.
Hell yeah.
So whose nasal passage
is it? I said nasal,
anyway?
By the way. I mean, that's nasal, not...
I don't know. Whose nose is it ever with WarioWare? There's always some bizarre giant nose or something, some sort of monolith. Or there's one like where, I think in WarioWare Twisted, you have like a scrolling shooter type thing consisting entirely of noses.
Oh, yeah.
What is your obsession with noses?
that's delicious.
It's kind of like Choaniki, except nasal instead of homoerotic.
But isn't that the same thing? I mean, look at it. I mean, it's got two circles and a straight part. I mean,
confirmed. Not naked man flying up nose for the sequel.
Yeah.
All right, this conversation, this is a freewheeling conversation, sometimes devolves into adult topics. Your discretion is advised.
Yeah, and with that, James Jones, bring it with what you've been playing lately.
Well, considering that I've done something in the neighborhood of 46 RFNs in the last 3 days.
Oh yeah.
I'm sorry.
You won't get most of them being put in a time capsule to be discovered in the 30 seconds.
Sometimes in March.
The 32nd century is when I'm planning.
What I've been playing, and I've almost got to the point where I'm comfortable reviewing it, is Tomb Raider Underworld.
Yes. We discussed this last week.
We did. I complained a little bit about it.
Your further work. Yeah, there was a lot about the game breaking bug, so we'll skip over that.
Woo!
Yes, the issue, the true game breaking in this is the camera. The camera is an asshole.
Yes. Again, you mentioned that. You get mentioned.
No, but
see,
I want to put. I've changed my position on the camera. The camera is, in fact, the character. I'm convinced.
So is this the character that's like sitting in front of you? Yeah, is he like the character sitting in front of you at a movie theater that's like eating popcorn loudly and talking on the telephone? Or
No, he's the camera in front of you that walks up to your children and tells them horrible things. he's the character that's just a general ass at all times.
See that monster on the movie? He's under your bed in the evening.
he's the kind of guy that at meetings at work will just like start talking about random things we're trying to listen, or you know, makes fun of you, or maybe stabs your tires when you're staying late.
And this manifests itself in the game how?
Well, it manifested itself in a playthrough today of a particular jumping platforming crap that you have to get from the bottom of this floor, you know, three stories up, and you make one mistake and you fall to the bottom. You might die, you might not die, depending on how high you are, and the almost arcane ritual that determines how far one must fall to die. My personal favorite being, I fell like 2.5 feet and died. It was amazing. And not only did I die, I bounced after I hit the ground and spun around like ragdoll physics, hit the wall, bounced off the wall, and hit the ground again. It was amazing.
Well, you know, gravity changes depending on where you are.
I didn't even fall as tall as Lara is. It was amazing.
Yeah, so isn't there some infamous game where you die like just by falling a few inches or something like that? Was it Spelunker, maybe?
Well, it's a bit like that, or sometimes you can fall 6 feet, fine.
It's more inconsistent.
Yeah, it's wildly inconsistent. But in this particular jumping puzzle, you basically died if you thought about falling.
Stop thinking.
I might fall here. Oh, she died. So I'm climbing up to the top, and there was this particular jump where the camera zooms way out.
Oh, no.
Like to Montego Bay from an Aztec ruin. So you're way out there. I mean, you can see Lara in the sense that I can see the Earth.
So like she's like 5 pixels tall then.
Yeah, something like that. She's tiny. And I can't see the platform I'm jumping to because it's behind her relative to the camera. And sure, why not?
Deal with it.
I can't tell if she's leaning back or not because it doesn't always work if she is. You know, you have to – even if you're holding backwards, she might not turn around and look at the thing she's jumping to. Just doesn't feel like doing it. So, this is the last jump, and I have fallen probably 20 times trying to get up there. I hit it, she jumps straight up, and since I'm holding back, she starts to go backwards, misses both platforms, falls. I kid you, she fell for like 11 seconds. I'm like, just hit the ground.
And she lives,
ground,
right?
Hit the ground. No, she hit the ground, she died, and she bounced like a goddamn Super Bowl. She's boom, boom.
Just like real life.
Yeah, just like real life. And then I had to do the whole thing over again. And the amazing thing is, I finally finished it, and there's no checkpoint there.
Jesus.
Instead, you're attacked by jaguars.
Yeah,
two
that's,
of them.
That's your reward for doing that puzzle.
I did get killed up there by being knocked off the side. Thank you, jaguars. Second time I was ready for them, I had my machine gun ready. I killed them, and then I took a few steps into this hallway, checkpoint. I took 6 more steps down the hallway, turned a corner, checkpoint. The game's checkpoint placement is bizarre. I mean, there have been instances where checkpoint, 5 seconds later, checkpoint, another minute later, checkpoint, and then you go an hour without one. It was like, they won't expect us to put a jaguar right at the top of this climbing
puzzle.
It's
like they'll be so on it, their way of creating tension, you know. It's just like, God, I really don't want to do that again. I really hope some jaguars don't come and jack me up. Oh, no.
The little reticle that follows your pointer on the Wii Remote, I've been aiming it at the back of her head and pulling the trigger button, just wishing it would fire from my perspective.
There's your box code, Suicidal Raider.
just put it in.
It makes you want to kill yourself.
I think we should probably put that. That would be valuable context for people when they read the review. That most of the time you weren't actually aiming at anything that you can shoot.
If only I was like, if I pulled the trigger, would you take her pistol out and do it? No, personally not. She doesn't.
Oh dear.
It's weird. It's a bad game. That's bad to play, but just looking at it and playing it for a while, you don't get the feeling it's bad.
Well, again, I think that's something that's not unexpected from a game that's sort of on the 1 year development cycle, is that, you know, it's about passing the eyeball test first.
Yeah.
And then, you know, everything else kind of gets lost in the shuffle on the compressed schedule.
Right.
All right, I'm going to finish off new business. I don't have a lot to report due to the timing of the recording of this episode. I did get in for review Pokemon Ranger Shadows of Almia.
Sounds delicious.
Which, by all accounts, is very, very similar to the original Pokemon Ranger, which I didn't play, so obviously that doesn't kind of hold for me, but it's, you know, it's kind of your roster update type thing. But it's funny when TYP was talking about Tails, because this has, I mean, it's the first, it has very, very basic play mechanics, and yet more than the first 2 hours are dedicated to the tutorial for those. It's the most slow, drawn out beginning to a game I've ever played. It's remarkably drawn out. It's very little to teach. You just encircle the Pokemon with your stylus to capture them.
Can you draw a circle, kids?
And you draw a line between a Pokemon and an obstacle for them to sort of negate it if they have an ability that can do that, and that's about it. And yet for the first 2 hours plus of the game, all you're doing is learning that and just getting story exposition.
Who's the developer of this series?
I'm not sure who's the developer of the Pokemon Ranger series at this point. It might bear looking into when I start writing the review. But it's just very. It kind of caught me a little by surprise, considering this is a sequel to a game that came out fairly recently. You know, so that part of it, I thought perhaps it might be a little more streamlined, but it seems like it's sort of, they haven't done it that way at all. They've played it very conservatively, played it safe for younger players and things.
Yeah. It's HAL, by the way, the developer.
Really?
Right, HAL Laboratory.
Get it. I mean, I expect better from Nintendo on this sort of thing. I mean, I know that they're really, really, really conservative with Pokemon franchise, but Nintendo knows how to make a good tutorial, and HAL knows how to make a good tutorial. So if HAL's really the developer behind it, and that isn't just a front.
I think some of it is because it's not just the tutorial aspect. I think it's this thing of, like, it's trying to immerse you in this idea that you're sort of living the life of a Pokemon Ranger, you know, sort of trying to kind of, like, you know, because the whole tutorial part is that you're sort of in your training school.
I see.
And so a lot of it is just talking to your schoolmates, to the teachers, and just, like, running around the school grounds. There's very little gameplay at all. And I think that's just something that's aimed at younger players, that they might enjoy. They might find it more involving. But obviously for someone who isn't, or perhaps even for a younger player that's played the first one, so they've kind of, you know, they've done the whole routine before, they might find that kind of a little excessive.
All right, Greg,
they'll still buy it.
I'm looking at an image of the cover art.
Yes.
Is it as silly as it looks right now? Because it looks pretty silly.
Well, you know, it's you running around with, you know, a bunch of Pokemon.
I don't mean the game. I just mean the cover.
Oh, the cover. Well, it is what it is, James. It's not three-dimensional when you get the box in your hands or something.
I just like the image of, what's his name? The blue thing with spikes out of his hand. Pumping his fist in what looks like celebratory rage.
No, it's all very emotional and dramatic, by which I mean asking your teachers
about
the
red
stuff.
Thing next to him with his mouth open.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of Pokemon just aghast at what's going on. They're like, oh my God, you're taking this long to introduce droid circles? Ah, I don't believe it. You know, so, yeah, I mean, I don't have a whole lot to say about it because it really, I mean, I've played for several hours, but I just don't feel like the game's gotten going yet. Anyway, that's enough of that. That's new business done. Before we go to a break, due to the timing of the recording of this episode, there's no DLC Mondays to comment on. And if it's as,
because it's Saturday.
If it's as rip roaringly entertaining as the last week's, then it probably is no no great loss. Where
it's going to be Block Breaker Supreme.
We were forced to discuss the finer
and
points
tennis
of
from the NES.
We were forced to discuss the finer points of Master System box art, which of course is totally pertinent to downloadable games. So what I do want to talk about before we go to the break is the fact that it's a very big, but not necessarily particularly surprising announcement that Dragon Quest X is coming to the Wii.
Yep.
I guess, woo, exclusively.
Yes.
Now, obviously, for some people...
Greg, remember, that came bundled with the fact that Dragon Quest IX still exists. So, the game's coming out when, Greg?
March 28th, Dragon Quest IX is coming
out.
Yeah,
so March 28th, Japan will cease to exist as a nation.
Yeah. Possibly. Although then it wouldn't be much point announcing Dragon Quest X, so hopefully
right.
You have contingencies
which is
for that.
Greg?
Yeah, so Dragon Quest X is for the Wii exclusive. There had been discussion that maybe Dragon Quest IX would sort of morph into this Echoes of Time Crystal Chronicles thing, that maybe it would be on Wii and DS, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen now because they had this event, you know, primarily about Dragon Quest IX, say when it's coming out and all that, and then Iwata came out, presumably with a very gloating smile on his face.
That smug little self-satisfied grin he has.
Wait, which Iwata? Which Iwata? Isn't the president of...
No, we're talking about Satoru Iwata.
Okay. So the Iwatas got together and like... Mwah, mwah,
yeah. Mwah. Pretty much gloat over the fact that, yes, this is going to be... It's a very big deal, obviously, because, you know, it's a premier franchise. It's very well loved. A lot of people, you know, had a very high opinion of Dragon Quest VIII, which was on the PS2. But also, it's just such a big deal for the sort of the market implications, because this pretty much, well, I mean, the Wii's almost unassailable in Japan anyway at this point, but now it will be much further unassailable. But I think the more important ramifications is on the software side, that it could signal the beginning of more RPG content for a start. Because obviously, there's going to be.
Don't forget about Monster Hunter.
Well, there's like 75 Tales.
Oh, we know. Yeah, I mean, Monster Hunter 3 is a similarly big deal. Obviously, it's not as well known as Dragon Quest is in the West, but that doesn't diminish its significance in Japan that's coming out for Wii. But I guess the big thing with Dragon Quest X is it's essentially so many people would. And this is a point that John likes to make, that, you know, Dragon Quest game is so big that, you know, it's going to sell on any system you put it on. Obviously,
Atari Jaguar.
It's going to sell in huge quantities no matter what. People will buy the system for it, whatever it takes. They'll pay exorbitant prices for it.
It is important because, like, at the moment, the Wii is selling to not really to hardcore gamers in Japan. It's the same as what's happening in other parts of the world. The best-selling game is Wii Sports, which doesn't come packed with the system.
Yeah, it doesn't come packed.
So that shows you
who's
buying the system.
It's sold about 3 million units and stuff. Yeah, I mean, look, the evidence from Japan is just to say it's selling to an expanded audience and all that sort of thing. And, of course, what Dragon Quest may be able to do is get people that have been sitting on the fence, you know, that are maybe more, that are obviously into the JRPGs and their more traditional games. And therefore, the point is, when they do that, when people buy Wiis just to play Dragon Quest X, then other developers, and of course Square Enix itself, will know that the market has literally been created within the Wii user base for these games just by that. You know, as soon as they have Wiis and they have the Dragon Quest X,
this isn't an unfounded statement to make either, because there is the infamous Final Fantasy VII decision.
Yeah.
Where.
Boos.
I know, it's not a popular topic amongst Nintendo fans, but. It really did help Sony in the end.
Of course, it did.
I'll never forgive Square for that poster that they put up. In the poster, it said 10 million polygons, never possible on a cartridge. That's what the advertisement for Final Fantasy VII said. I never forgive them for that.
10 million polygons. Where were the other?
You got to love
whatever it was. It was a big number.
99,000 that made up the characters.
You got I mean, it was more. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, obviously, the big thing with Final Fantasy VII, in many respects, was not.
They rubbed it in.
Well, it wasn't so much about back. It wasn't so much this Dragon Quest X. Obviously, it's never been sort of as sort of technically leveraged as Final Fantasy.
No,
right.
But this is about backing the winner. This is about the biggest user base.
But you know, Square's backing everybody though. I mean,
With Dragon Quest, they're backing the winner. Now the thing with, if you look at the Final Fantasy VII decision, that was about storytelling. It was about the fact that the constraints of cartridge base meant they weren't going to be able to do, you know, these cutscenes, you know, these video cutscenes, things like that, and be able to sort of expand their narrative. Sort of swath as vastly as they would like, and so in the end, it wasn't so much just about power, you know, or just graphics in a linear sense.
It's kind of happening again because, like, Final Fantasy 13 could never happen on the Wii. So we're getting Dragon Quest instead, and I think some of the reason
why Final Fantasy 13 would be has always been planned for PlayStation 3 is just presumptuousness that it would be doing better than it is because it's the PlayStation brand, but it's also because of Blu-ray, presumably.
It's coming to the 360.
Yeah, I was going to that. The point being that now their presumptuousness about PS3 success has been proven so wrong that they feel they have to release it on 360.
Well, that game costs so much money to make that...
Yes, you know, they're going to need to recoup as much as possible, and therefore you can't ignore a user base the size of the 360s. But my point is, when they're making the decision originally to where to put it, they're probably thinking, Blu-ray's going to give us everything we could want to do with storytelling. Any ridiculous excesses that we want to go to, we can go to.
8-hour cutscenes in.
Yeah, so
that's just the intro cutscene.
So back to Dragon Quest X, I think is more pertinently is I guess there's reason to believe that it could be a very fine game, and you know, fans of the series will enjoy it, and it may introduce a whole lot of new people to the series possibly. But I think the really important thing is that this could be a sort of, especially in the Japanese market, and a turning point for, you know, if the user base itself hasn't convinced third parties to which it kind of has in this case, to make more traditional games for the Wii, then this might.
You make this point that it'll convince traditional gamers, whatever you want to call them, people that like things like Dragon Quest, to buy the game. But to be honest, I mean, the Dragon Quest series is a little more casual. At least in a Japanese mindset.
Well, I think when you're talking about a breadth of something, you know, what it is essentially is mainstream. I mean, anything that sells the way it sells, you can't call it hardcore or anything like that.
It isn't. It's very approachable.
But there is doubtlessly a great subset of Dragon Quest fans that are traditional gamers,
yes,
hardcore gamers, whatever you want to say, that may well be induced to buy a Wii by this, and therefore that they will be and market unto themselves then within the Wii user base that subsequent games can be sold to them after that.
And that will also happen with Monster Hunter as well. I think all the PSP crowd, that's all that people buying a PSP for is Monster Hunter. So when that comes out, all of those people will have another, you know, reason to buy a Wii as well.
And this is a mainline.
Okay, so do we need to wait for these games to be released, or do you think that
it's time to start shifting your development resources now. I mean, because you know, a lot of these people that we're talking about may well be ready to buy a Wii in advance if they haven't already, you know. So why not get in on the ground floor? I mean, as much as possible. And there's no telling how long Dragon Quest X could take to arrive. Certainly 9 has taken its time, you know, since the big announcement that was going to the DS, which obviously was the preeminent platform at the time and still is.
2012 really. Release date confirmed.
So, but the very decision itself, you know, is very important. And yeah, it could well have an effect in advance. And I just think that it comes in the wider trend of just how ridiculously successful the Wii is at this point, and it's truly dominant in Japan because the PS3 isn't doing that great, but there isn't a 360 of meaningful sort of consequence.
Well,
it's getting a little stronger.
Every getting moved.
Every so often, there's a particular game that comes out, and that helps.
Greg, I'll just point out that over 500 units were sold last month. So put that in your pipe.
There you go. But you see the point there that now it's going to be so dominant in Japan that really you would hope that would spur a lot of developers to put some resources into it. Because I think the point being that there's been this kind of narrative that however many Wiis are out there, there aren't actually that many gamers to sell games to in terms of the very specific kind of gamer. But once you have something like a Dragon Quest that's going to be, and I mean obviously just the sheer size as well, that even if you're selling to a small percentage of the user base, the actual absolute size of that number of people is big enough to justify your allocating serious development resources to it. And let's face it, I mean, it shouldn't take as much in the way of development resources to make a great Wii game as it should when you've got to concern yourself with the HD consoles and the graphics. So there's a lot of ways in which it makes sense, and yet we haven't quite seen it yet, have we? I mean, I
hope that we get a sequel to Dragon Quest Swords in the meantime.
Oh. Now, see,
more
the question
waggle.
Is, do you think Monster Hunter will get a release date in anticipation of 10? And sort of, we need to really be serious about this game now.
Well, considering that, you know, Monster Hunter 3 was there at TGS this year, I don't think he has to worry too much about Dragon Quest 10. You know, like, I think it's sufficiently far.
I don't know. I mean, both Dragon Quest 9 and Monster Hunter have been in development hell forever.
Yeah, well, I guess the thing is just that you've got unless 10 is somehow more close to 9 than you think or something, like it is more like what we were talking about earlier, this kind of cross-platform thing. You would assume that it's some years away. So
I heard that they're going to use the same engine from the DS game on the Wii game, so it should be all right.
Oh yeah, so graphically,
well, I guess
it's fine.
Like I said, that's. I mean, they're doing that for one game, so you never know. But, I mean, even if they're not planning
Square.
Now, they could do that later on with Dragon Quest IX. They could actually do a sort of re-release of Dragon Quest IX on the Wii in anticipation of when 10 comes out or something.
If the Wii can handle it.
Oh dear.
Not sure.
Low blow.
Thank you, Lindy Surrogate.
On that bombshell.
Hardcore gamer.
Somebody's got to pick up the slack with Mr. Linderman not absent. Right, with that, we're off to a break. And when we come back, we've got a listener mail and an interesting feature topic about outsourcing of beloved properties. So come back. And we're back. We're going to start the second segment with some listener mail. I've got the first question here. This is from Adolf Vega, Denton, Texas, and he was sending us an email sort of setting up the context of the economic global economic downturn that's going on. And he said, I can't imagine casual gamers will decide they would rather buy a Wii than buy groceries, or buy a Wii instead of paying the heating bill, or buy another game or accessory if they're fearful that the company they work for might go bankrupt. Potentially, the horrible economy will destroy the casual market first, and since Nintendo all but burnt its bridges with hardcore gamers, the Wii might see an epic crash. Do you think this scenario is likely? Now,
2.04 million we sold last month. End of conversation.
I didn't include this question to be unkind to Adolf, because to be fair, there have been analysts that have said similar things, that the Nintendo, not that it would necessarily be a crash, but they might get hit harder by an economic downturn than the other sort of more core focused purveyors of games, but in this case apparently not, because the November NPD's 2 million units, which is an
2.04 million units,
2 million Wii sold, which is a doubling of what it sold in 2007.
2 million times $6, right?
I think it goes the other direction, to be honest. In general, like, entertainment is somewhat recession-proof historically, because people want to, you know, don't want to think about the hard times. They want to have a distraction. You know, back in the Great Depression, movies were really popular because, you know, all sorts of stupid, yeah, funny comedies were what people wanted to watch. They wanted to forget about their troubles. And I think with something like a video game console, there's such value in, you know, if you're a smart shopper, if you buy games that can last a really long time. Yeah. I mean, you go to a movie, and I don't know about in the rest of the world or in the rest of America, but in California, you can easily spend $10 or $12 going to a movie. So, I mean, compare that with, you know, buying something like, well, maybe not Smash Brothers, because that's more for the traditional gamer, but buying just
Mario Kart Wii is a great example, because people are definitely buying that, as is shown up with over 600,000 units sold in November alone. And I think that, this is the quote unquote staycation argument, you know, that people
absolutely
don't have money to go away.
so they
end up actually substituting their sort of recreational dollars out of vacations and things like that into stuff they can do at home. And like you said, gaming can be a good value proposition for
absolutely. I mean, if you're flying somewhere in America, it's $200, $300, $400 a person. If you have a family of three people, even, which is kind of generous, three people going off to, who knows, Orlando, Florida for Disneyland or something. I mean, compare that with how much it costs to buy Wii and 20 games. I mean...
And of course, that's that you know, that once you have the vacation, it's gone, apart from the holiday snaps or whatever. But, you know, with a console, it's durable.
Or the scars, emotional, physical, or other.
Yeah. So I mean, I guess that the point being that to some extent you could argue that that's what's happened. Although, on the other hand, I mean, you could also argue that this is simply Nintendo finally getting supply in. Because
I think that's what it is.
I think that's a big part of it. That what we see here is the fact that, you know, there's been this pent up demand for Wii because they haven't been able to keep pace, and of course they have ramped up production gradually and presumably, you know, been stockpiling to a certain extent to sort of blitz places with units for the Thanksgiving period, and they got snapped up very quickly, and then you end up with twice as many sold as last year, which obviously was a huge, huge month.
I think that's what a lot of it is. I'm willing to attribute all of it to that. Actually,
I think it's a big factor, but I mean, the other part in the equation is that, you know, have they even given that's true, could they have sold even more if there wasn't an economic downturn?
That number was American, and since I'm the only person in America right now on the podcast,
Captain America over there.
Yeah. I do see signs up at stores now. There's still signs, which indicates there is a fair amount here, but I do see some signs up that say, yes, we have Wii's in stock.
Yeah.
And I don't see them all the time, but I do see them every so often, which is a change because I hadn't seen that. You know, I've seen Wii's on store shelves before this month. a grand total of 2 times since
launch. Well, but that's the point. I mean, if they have increased supply, like I said, who knows? Perhaps these numbers that we're seeing, as impressive as they are, have actually had a little shaved off the top by the economic situation. In fact, they could have easily sold more still.
Oh, yeah, that's quite possible. They might have... It might have been 2.5, 2.6.
Maybe that would be just over their ability to supply. But the fact is, what we do know is that, yes, there isn't going to be a crash. There isn't. I mean, this is pretty. This, along with what we were talking about with Dragon Quest in the Japanese market and all, this performance in the North American market pretty much cements its Nintendo's complete domination for this generation.
And the DS is doing well.
The DS sold over 1.5 million units now going into.
It's
4 years old at this point.
Nintendo sold 3.5 million video game systems in North America last month.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is absurd.
It's crazy.
But here's another point to make out. The 360 sold 800,000 units in that month, which is a good month.
Obviously the 360, you know, in terms of this issue of sort of substituting to sort of something cheaper for entertainment, some of those deals on 360s, the arcade packs,
cheaper.
Whatever, very, very competitive indeed.
Yeah, it's cheaper. The arcade pack
exactly.
Is
$200, right? So it's and yet still the Wii.
And it comes with two games, two casually appealing games. What is it? Kung Fu Panda and something
one of
else.
Them, one of them's Kung Fu Panda. That's what I remember.
Soul.
There you go. I mean, but so they did pretty well, much better than the PS3.
And the PS3 sold what, 200,000 units? Something truly atrocious like that.
Roughly similar to what the PlayStation 2 sold in the same.
Yeah,
time.
they have got to be just feeling.
Yeah, it's tough, and that's where maybe you see they get the PlayStation 3 may well be getting hammered. Actually, rather, you know, is it, because the problem is, it's all well and good saying, the core gamers are the one that are going to keep spending or whatever, so they'll see you through tough times. Problem is, the core gamers have already bought the PS3.
Yeah.
Most of them have already made their purchase decision on that. So you do need to broaden out if you want to keep selling at this point in the generation's life.
This is a very international podcast, by the way.
Yeah.
I just feel like knowing that right now, that we are on 3 different continents.
Yep.
Go internet.
Oh yes, we're truly Nintendo World Report.
Yes, for once in our title's history, it is truly accurate. But we have one thing I want to point out on this particular discussion is that it's kind of a weird situation to be in, because Nintendo is at about that point where you feel like it's price drop time, you know? It's been two.
What do you mean? Like just in terms of normally,
just in terms of what we're used
in.
To for the cycle. This is price drop time. This is the Christmas. They should have shaved at least $50 off the price, and they haven't. And there's no reason for them to do it.
And they've doubled sales by not doing it.
I wonder if they did do it. You know, let's say they built up another big supply like this for next Christmas and did it, shave $50 off, $100 off. Would they have another just absolute rush on them? I mean. They have space to go down if demand cuts off.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's true. That if you know the situation were to get much worse economically, Nintendo is relatively well situated to actually cut price and induce
Microsoft,
more.
Microsoft, however, has slashed their prices.
They're already
6 or 7 times.
They've
now.
Already
they
gone
can't
to the point.
Go any further.
That's true. And clearly,
so
the PS3 can't go further. Yeah. Because if they could have done, they would have done, because they don't want to be this high.
Right, and they keep getting asked, are you going to do it now? And they're like, no, we have no reason to do it. But in reality, they do have reason to do it. But they're not. So you have to assume the reasoning they don't have to do it is they can't afford to do it. But there is an interesting parallel that I saw yesterday, or not yesterday, the day before yesterday. It was an old report from 1990 on, like, I think it was the Today Show, about the NES.
Okay,
and how there was
I saw that.
We were in the middle
of
the recession at this at that point. And
and
the Sega Genesis with
its
more hardcore fan base was coming out and being a true challenger to the 8-bit NES, and how they were thought that the hardcore challenger in the recession would do better than the NES. And in 1990, the NES had an amazing year. And it parlayed itself well into the SNES in, what was it, 92?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the NES had legs, didn't it? Big legs. I mean, you know,
yeah.
For a long
I mean,
time.
It had an amazing year, in part because the NES was a fairly casual system for the time.
Sure.
Well, it certainly had that more mainstream recognition, you know.
It had one in three homes in 1990 owned an NES.
And you know, the whole sort of just this Nintendo being synonymous with gaming itself, you know, gaming.
You
I mean, it had truly mainstream recognition.
Not even the Wii is even close to one in three American homes having a Wii.
Yeah, but of course, I mean, by 1990, it'd been on sale in America since, what, 86? So,
yeah,
I mean,
a long time.
Yeah.
Well, 86, kinda, and then truly in 87.
So I think we should move on to the next...
Yeah, we'll move. James, you have the next letter.
Right. Sophia writes, what game for any system did you feel most let down by this year, and what game were you most surprised by in terms of quality?
Ooh, good question. Well, I think everyone's going to say, if they've played it, they're going to say Animal Crossing City Folk, right?
I didn't play it because I knew I was going to be let down if I played it. I was let down
exactly,
with the GameCube game.
It's an N64 game. What are you talking about?
Yeah, you could go back about. I mean, it's a bit tricky to say because sometimes, like, if you're disappointed by how something's received, you don't end up playing it. You know, like, for it, there's a number of things like that. I guess, I mean, the really obvious candidate, if you want to narrow it down from a game to an aspect of a game, is the Smash Brothers Online is kind of disappointing.
Yeah.
But then
I didn't have
very high expectations for that. I assumed.
No, but you had a heads up that it was coming. I mean, we got it, and we really, really appreciate how bad it was. I think Japan isn't as big into the online gaming as I understand it.
I think since everyone's much closer, it's also a little bit of a better experience. I've played it online,
but
and it worked pretty well. I played it online here, and it worked pretty well.
When it hit the U.S., we were like, holy, this is terrible. And it was just unacceptable here.
Exactly. I mean, that was pretty disappointing, even if you had kind of realistic expectations.
You had those 7 weeks of notice before you even got a release date.
We don't want to just ruthlessly...
The countdown to the release date, I remember that.
We don't want to ruthlessly slog over that just over again. So in terms of actual games,
one game that answers both parts of that question. The most let down and the most surprised by quality, it has to be Mario Kart Wii. Because I was really surprised with how good the online was, but I was kind of let down with like how much it hadn't changed in other aspects.
Mario Kart Wii is pretty similar to Animal Crossing City Folk in the sense that it is very strongly leveraged on the DS game. It's very similar to the DS game.
Well, it's a GameCube and DS like remix.
It's like a hybrid.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's because obviously it dispatches with the whole dual cart thing. I hated
Double Dash, and
there were parts of that I liked, the sort of character specific items and stuff like that was kind of cool. I mean, they could have kept that with one player.
I didn't like the character specific items, but I liked the two card thing, but the special items I thought were.
I don't know whether the execution was as good as it could have been, but
I didn't like either of those.
Something to give the characters more of a sort of involved part rather than just let them be avatars is kind of a good idea, I think. But the point is, Mario Kart Wii is very fundamentally conservative iteration of a Mario Kart series, just like City Folk is for the Animal Crossing series. So I guess, again, the letdown there is mitigated by the fact that it was so entirely predictable.
I haven't played all that many games this year, to be honest, that I can think of right now. Certainly not all that many that were a lot worse than I expected. But if I can answer it by saying my biggest letdown is the lack of Nintendo games, period, for the DS this year. They really took
a sabbatical.
They did. I don't know if it was sort of like, oops, they didn't realize it ahead of time and it was just sort of bad planning.
Oh, crap,
or
we still have that thing?
Or is it just like, well, we don't need to make any more. This stuff's still selling.
Yeah.
And we got like Square Enix that's churning out all sorts of stuff.
Yeah,
so why don't we just,
yeah, I mean,
you know,
that's the
back.
Thing. I mean, as a whole, the DS software this year, there was plenty to enjoy. But...
Oh, absolutely.
But from Nintendo, not so much. And,
not even Brain Training 3. Where was that?
Brain Training 3. Train your
And that's led us to speculate that they're starting to roll out their new real successor to the DS, which may or may not be true, yeah. But it's possible they're shifting some of their projects over.
I just think it seems to me like the DSi is a kind of bridge between a full scale, you know, the DS Lite and a full scale successor console. It'll be more fundamentally different. But that if it is a bridge, that implies that we've got quite a bit more time to wait, and therefore the fact that they seem to have just stopped making many games is still very curious in that context. So yeah,
they make
more money by
not actually making games. They make more money by not making games. That's what I'm afraid they're starting to do. I'm afraid that Nintendo's trend is to go that way.
You know, they're not being proactive anymore with the DS, and that I would agree is something of a letdown, because this still seems like there's so many great experiences you could have on DS. You know, just because it's a sort of aging platform, there's no reason why you couldn't have a lot of really great new Nintendo games, but there isn't. I guess surprise quality, it's kind of tough to narrow down, but in some ways I'm really surprised by just how wonderful Wario Land Shake it is.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, I'm kind of on all levels that, you know, that actually the amount of effort that ended up, you know, going into the game in terms of the animation and all that, and that it was in development for quite a long time, and then the actual gameplay itself and some of the level designs and stuff, like especially the more advanced stuff. I mean, it really is. And of course, what it is, an old school 2D game on a console, all of that stuff is just a wonderful surprise to me. When you take it all the way back, you just wouldn't think that would happen. So
yeah,
that is a standout.
Well, there have been some other surprises in some of the WiiWare titles that you wouldn't even expect. Like,
I guess the thing with WiiWare is you kind of, you know, that's the kind of thing where you kind of think anything can happen. You know, because it's all so small scale and all that. What's so wonderful about Wario is just that, you know, they actually went to the effort with a console game. You know, like that's, you just think that the possibilities with a retail released console game are so much narrower that when you have something that kind of busts out of that, it's really good to see.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, Mega Man 9, I don't know whether you want to call Capcom rehashing a franchise surprising, but the way they did it was really quite surprising that it was this sort of completely faithful thing, and that was nice. Anything, James? The Jameses? Have you anything James to say in this regard?
Well, I think disappointment? I'm kind of disappointed by Tomb Raider, but that's not really here or there.
you were looking forward to that?
Well, there's a difference between looking forward to and not expecting to be shit upon. I would say the game that most surprised me in terms of quality, it's not a big title or anything, is actually the Speed Racer DS game I reviewed. Because I fully expected...
Oh, yeah, you thought it was pretty good, didn't you?
I fully expected to get an atrocious piece of shovelware. And I ended up getting, I think, a game I gave a 7.5 that looks phenomenal for a DS game. And plays reasonably well. And the only real knock I had against it was the lack of online play and the fact it was ridiculously short.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. All right, we'll move on to the next question. TYP, you've got that.
All right. Andy in Des Moines, Iowa writes, pick a game or franchise that has had no new installments or sequels since the 8-bit era. Which one are you going to bring to Wii or DS? My pick? Bring back Faxinado with a DS remake. Faxinado, I'm sorry, for the DS remake. Great games, great graphics, great games. We did use Faxinado with a radio trivia.
I might have been on that episode.
Yeah, I remember it having very good music. I really don't know anything about the game, though.
Yeah, I remember. Was that the one we were trying to figure out what it was? No, that was that game where you play a ship that turns into a woman that turns into something else.
That sounds awesome.
I don't remember this.
I remember because neither of us knew what the game was. It was a listener suggestion. And then I'm like reading the Wikipedia page going, oh my God, what am I going to say about this game?
so obviously we can't really comment on Faxinado, but we can answer the question. For me, there are quite a few. I mentioned Pildenball Quest in the past, which I've already talked about. But instead, since Johnny isn't here, I'm going to say Star Tropics because... it's a fun game. It was the end of the NES's life cycle, and we never really got another chance. And
he's not only saying a remake, though, is he? Isn't he just saying a sequel? Because I'm just looking at this Faxanadu, because apparently it's a side story of Xanadu. It is a second installment in the Falcon's long-running RPG series, Dragon Slayer.
Oh, well, I think his point is a sequel to a series or a game that hasn't existed since the 8-bit era. So, yeah, Star Tropics, I mean, some would argue it's kind of similar to Zelda, and they'd be right, but it had a different feel, had more of a Western take on it. In fact, I don't know the details of where it was developed. It may have actually been developed with Western portion of Nintendo of America, because the executive producer was actually not Yamauchi. God, I can't pronounce words right now, but it was NOA president at the time. Arakawa? Who's the...
Yeah.
You know, oh, right. Yeah. Is it Yamauchi's son-in-law?
Yeah, son-in-law. That in the original Star Tropics, that was the executive producer. And I don't know the details of why, but... so I think that would be a really good pick for...
because there's not that many that haven't had, so, you know, I mean, there's franchises that are coming left by the roadside by, you know, by Nintendo, speaking from a Nintendo point of view anyway, but, you know, they've generally milked them for something over the years.
Well, you know, apart from the IGN's favorite pick for that.
Kid Icarus.
And that's Kid Icarus.
It did have a sequel.
Which they tell us constantly is coming out.
It did have a sequel for the original Game Boy.
Which is still 8-bit.
Much like Metroid. But it's still 8-bit, So it did get some sort of
extension.
It's
actually 8-bit with black and white.
Yeah, it didn't put the 8-bit era quite. I don't know whether anybody is pumped for Kid Icarus. I've never played the original. It doesn't really...
There was the demo in Smash Brothers, right? You could play it for like a few seconds.
It's a little bit brutal.
30 seconds.
That's my take on it. You know, I played it well after its heyday, and it just feels just like it's a game designed to be pain.
It is. I mean, it feels like the original Metroid, only with less purpose.
It was developed pretty much.
It's the same engine. I mean, it's the same game engine.
The same fundamental gameplay.
The only difference is, as opposed to going horizontal, you just go up.
Yeah. By the way, I call bullshit on Kid Icarus. I think Masamasina.
Yes, I'm not the only one.
Egg on his face.
I think he's just messing with his readers. Yeah, it's coming this time.
Weird,
honest.
It just
seems weird to dangle out there, because in terms of like
he's digging
you're
a massive.
You're holding
grave.
Out hope for this though, really.
And he's been very specific about that game.
It could be. I mean, look, they've been so specific, it would certainly be a very huge sort of dent in their armor if nothing came of it ever. But the point being, I can't think of one from Nintendo. I think apart from Star Tropics, I guess, is pretty good that I haven't played the original. But one particular game I had in mind was from Rare, actually, during the 8-bit era, which is Cobra Triangle.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Awesome.
That's a really fun game. I think it's one of the last games I ever had for my NES before it broke, and then that it brought on the purchase of the Super Famicom. Really great game, fun music. It's been done on Radio Trivia, which brought back nice memories, because obviously I can't replay the game because my NES broke, so that was nice. And it was kind of quite a different kind of game. It was isometric, and it was like you did various kinds of tasks, didn't you? Some were like some races.
Yeah, there was like RC Pro Ram with a boat, and then mission based.
Yeah.
But then you had like some like sea monsters sometimes, like that came along at some point. I remember, like, you know, there was some stuff that was more like, you know, not sort of out of the racing game kind of realm.
Yeah, sometimes it was almost awesome like a shooter. Well. Like I remember this one level where you're supposed to like drive through a river or something, and there's obstacles and the like, and it feels a little more like a shooter level where you're trying to avoid things. So.
Yeah, it's pretty varied for the time, wasn't it? You know, so I mean, I guess Rare at this point, you know, it doesn't seem likely they'd ever bring it back. Something I'd like to see. You could probably do something pretty interesting with it now. So, do we have anything further?
I've got one. What about Marble Madness? Did that get a sequel on the SNES? I can't remember.
It might have, but I'm still going to count it.
I think there was a Genesis version, wasn't there?
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, 16-bit, 8-bit, you know, it's still way back now.
Well, I could just imagine something like, you know, Kororimpa or something like that. You know,
yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of games in that kind of vein, haven't there? Like Mercury Meltdown Revolution.
It's basically Marble Madness.
Mercury Meltdown Revolution.
Yeah.
So there have been spiritual sequels to that game. Spiritual,
yeah, there have been things that are giving you some of those same things, and I guess, yeah, with something like Marble, with that, it's not exactly a beloved, like, IP. The IP itself isn't some of the charm. Whereas, I guess, like, with Kid Icarus, it must exclusively be that, because whatever it's going to play like, it's going to be probably nothing like the original.
Yeah.
It'll be very, sort of, tangentially related to it at best. Jimmy Jones, anything further from you?
Nice. Yeah, I mean, I could use a Shining Force, but that's 16-bit and it's Genesis.
Sure. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, most of, because obviously the 16-bit era is fundamentally very similar to the 8-bit, then most stuff did get carried over in some form, usually,
yeah,
if you're somewhat successful.
Sega does what Nintendo don't. Apparently.
Except the fact that Shining Force is a ripoff of a Nintendo, of multiple games that Nintendo does have
in their life.
Yes.
All right. Well, that's going to bring listener mail to a close. Thanks for the questions. We've been trying to keep up with our commitment to doing listener mail all the time, and we will need more in order to continue to fulfill that commitment. So send your questions, comments, and suggestions to
give us your mail.
Yes, to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Thank you for enunciating that so well. Now, we're going to move on to our feature.
It's an email!
Jesus Christ. I hope people get that. Right, we're going to move on to our feature, which is at the suggestion of TYP, and I think it's a very pretty pertinent topic these days. It's about outsourcing of sort of beloved franchises or, you know, intellectual properties or whatever to sort of other development teams, for them to actually create a game where the original creators apparently have sort of lost interest or don't have the time to do it or whatever.
Right. For the purposes of this discussion, we're not talking about, like, outsourcing, say, I don't know, artwork for a Castlevania game, or outsourcing the music for the Okami or whatever. I don't know if they did that, but that's an example.
Sure. Yeah.
We're talking about where a publisher has an established franchise that either they've been working on internally with their own team, or they have buddied up with some third party for two or three, you know, iterations, and now they're going to give this franchise to a different development team, either internal or external, for either the next main one or a very, very high profile spinoff.
Yeah, really a changing of hands of the people that actually create the game itself. They're primarily responsible for its development,
right.
You know, and it's from something that, you know, people would be familiar with, you know, from, say, for instance, like, you know, EAD or whatever, would then be changing hands to somebody else. So I guess the first thing we're going to do, actually, because we're such a optimistic and pleasant bunch, is actually talk about the cases where these sorts of enterprises have actually turned out very well. With changing
never
hands
happened.
No. And we're talking about more than just Nintendo. Let's make that clear. Any publisher. I want this discussion to be open to any system, any publisher. So
yeah, obviously, you know, Nintendo have such a broad base of stable of franchises that they've done a lot of it. So there's plenty of prominent examples in that area. And I think one of the best, without doubt, in my mind, is F-Zero GX.
Oh, yeah.
Which was given over to Amusement Vision, who were the people that did the Monkey Ball games for GameCube, from Sega. And they did an excellent job with F-Zero GX. Absolutely outstanding.
Well, Greg, if I could be Miyamoto for a second, I would disagree with you.
Yeah,
F-Zero GX turned out to be a pile of shit because it didn't sell very well.
He basically said, sort of, yeah, he kind of made some noise that he didn't think it was, like, ended up being that great or whatever. But the thing is that I don't know for absolutely certain he was talking about F-Zero GX, because they did also outsource all of the GBA games.
Yeah, and there were, GBA games that I hadn't even heard of that I've only known.
Yeah,
there's one's
two
based on the anime.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah.
So
I've seen them here in Japan.
One would think that he was talking about F-Zero GX, perhaps just because it's more high profile, or maybe it didn't sell as well as was hoped, but there are other cases of F-Zero being outsourced, and, you know, with translation and stuff, I'm not completely certain, but regardless of Miyamoto's opinion on it, it was universally acclaimed,
awesome. Yeah.
Visually outstanding, certainly fulfilled all the promise that the series has ever held in terms of the speed, the sort of chaos of the F-Zero X sort of model of the
and the and the unnecessary hard difficulty of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of that. So it was very true to the thing. It did introduce some new elements like the story mode and stuff like that.
Story mode is a pile of crap though. Because
it's a fun novelty. No.
Samurai Goro's thing just sort of pokes around the track when I'm driving, and yet when I'm up against him, he's going faster than the freaking speed of light. It's ridiculous. That is crap.
Yeah, well, it gets pretty hard on the higher settings as well, doesn't it? Pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, it's rigged.
All the point being, it was very true to the series, and it was a very outstanding game. So there wasn't much to be.
It was fantastic.
Obviously, it wasn't going to convert people that didn't like F-Zero in the first place. But the point being that in terms of the franchise being put in their hands.
Yeah, I think it was also a very stunning looking game. I mean, just
visually. Yes. I mean, because of course, what it did is it kept all the speed and intensity of F-Zero X, but gave you a level of detail that really embellished that. Because
that you couldn't see as you blitzed by at 1,000 miles.
Yeah, but still, it was much more. It really made the speed more sort of visceral than it was in F-Zero X, because it was F-Zero X. Everything was so Spartan that it was kind of abstract. Yeah. You know, you didn't get that much of a sense of how fast you were going sometimes.
Did anyone ever like complete everything in that game and unlock the arcade tracks?
I didn't. Arcade tracks and all the arcade. Right, there were extra characters too, and I got all of them.
Yeah, I know. I've completed the story mode, and I was proud of myself for that. I definitely don't have all the cars or drivers. I didn't care to.
Yeah, it takes a lot of work to get those, but I mean, I just was enamored with it, very much so. So, let's open it up for more bids, more outstanding.
Before we move on, did anyone play the arcade version of that game?
I did. I did. I played it in Las Vegas. And I didn't do
all that
well.
Oh, that's a great place to play it.
But yeah,
it
looks
like Las Vegas.
Yeah, it feels like the GameCube game. It was a little weird because the
controllers were different. It had transferable data, didn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately, I wasn't able to fool around with that because I didn't have my GameCube.
Of course.
I was in Las Vegas. I didn't anticipate.
I just carried it around in my pocket.
Yeah, I was walking there, whatever. I was in Las Vegas for one reason or another, and I saw it. I'm like, oh, cool, I'm going to try it. Now, I don't think it has a tilt. Does it have a tilt cabinet?
The one that I played did. I played the one in Sega World in Tokyo, and that was like full tilting thing. It was awesome.
Uh-huh. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure I had one that had tilting, or if I did, I don't remember it. So it felt a little weird. But I enjoyed it. I mean, I didn't do well. It was fun. I'm not a big arcade person. I'm like, well, I have the game that feels exactly the same at home, and so I'm just going to do it at home.
Yeah, sure. They were pretty much the same game. So anybody else have a particularly cherished example?
Flagship's work on the Zelda series.
Yes, right. Excellent.
Oracle of Ages is my choice.
Yeah, so you've got Oracle of Ages and Seasons for the ZX
Game Boy
Color. You have their Four Swords work when they redid the GBA version of Link to the Past, and then you have the Minish Cap.
Well, I think the Oracle of Ages and Seasons were the best ones. To me, they were the most interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, they're all good games.
Yeah, they're all good games. You're absolutely right. So,
if any of those games came out on their own and they were the only game they made in the series, we would still probably point to them as a good example of this.
Mm-hmm. So why do you? What aspects of the game do you think they captured really well?
I think, especially in Seasons and Ages, it feels a lot like Link's Awakening.
No, it's using the same.
I mean, they feel exactly like Link's Awakening. They don't feel like Link to the Past. They don't feel like the first Zelda game, Legend of Zelda. They feel like Link's Awakening, and I think that's what I missed from the franchise. I really love Link's Awakening,
but it wasn't exactly like them. I mean, they did build on it. They had some interesting.
They did
new
build.
Ideas.
I mean, it's not just a copy.
Yeah, of course, Oracle of Ages had a switching between periods thing, which was like the Dark World, Light World of Link to the Past. So similar, and Seasons was actually originally a remake of the first Legend of Zelda, so it certainly had. Like, don't you fight some of the same bosses and things?
Similar bosses. They're modern versions of them.
It was supposed to be three games, which I found to be just ridiculous.
So they changed it.
Flagship thought they could take on three Zelda games at one time. And I think that still sticks out at me. They developed two full Zelda games on the Game Boy Color at the same time.
Absolutely.
And Flagship was not a big team. That still blows my mind to this day.
Well, and of course, it bears mentioning that Flagship, in addition to, as you said, they didn't just take on one game even at a time, but they were sort of like the custodians of the Zelda franchise on portable platforms for a number of years. But they also have done work on Kirby for the GBA. They did Amazing Mirror, which had some of the same sort of elements of Four Swords in terms of splitting apart Kirby into different guys and things. So they've worked quite a lot with Nintendo, but they ceased to exist. Is that right?
Yeah, yes, they disbanded.
They were folded back into Capcom proper.
Yeah,
which is sad because I was always kind of hoping that Nintendo would make a move on them because I felt like they were a competent team that Nintendo could hand over as custodians of their franchises, especially if they were internal.
So yeah. I think maybe we'll. We'll talk. We can talk some more about internal politics, things like that later. Before we get there, I'd like to talk about other games that were good. My pick is well, we mentioned it already, but Wario Land Shake It. I think it was an excellent resurrection of the Wario Land series and 2D platforming on the console in general.
And the developer is
Goodfeel.
Goodfeel.
And actually, they were founded by
like
Konami.
Pretty new.
They've been around for a year or two, but they were making really, really like budget titles, Japan only. This is the first real game, in my opinion, a serious attempt at a game. And pretty much, if you go to the Wario Land Shake It website, and there's a review with interview with a lot of the developers and. I mean, if you look at them, they hint at another company that a lot of them worked for. If you look at some of their credits on like Moby Games, they came from Konami, and and they've worked on their experiences range from like Circle of the Moon to some of the really old Konami NES games I think worked on Gradius. There was some other stuff too. So I mean, they have a real. Depth and breadth of gameplay experience there, and it shows in Wario Land, and they did an excellent job. They I want to wait a little later to discuss all the details, but they clearly looked at Wario Land, saw what made a Wario Land game a Wario Land game, and strive to make something new that captured the spirit of it. With the exploration, with the pacing, getting the basic controls that everyone cares about.
The puzzle elements also, which are very important to the Wario platformers.
The puzzles.
They're
excellent.
I think they really did a good job of sort of these. These got these really nice sort of self-contained puzzle areas. Really, you'll sort of go in a pipe. And then you'll appear in a room with one of those treasure chests, and basically the whole room is kind of like a physical platforming puzzle of how you're going to get to the treasure chest. And it's a very nice way of sort of introducing this more sophisticated gameplay in a way that's kind of, so it kind of is catering to a lot of different kinds of players, because you don't have to deal with it if you're, not a sort of experienced gamer or anything. You can just sort of get to the exit fine without. But if you want to find this stuff, there's some really interesting platform puzzles there. And you know what it reminds me of is some of these stuff like in Metroid games for missile expansions and energy tanks that are like really super complicated to get to. It's not quite on that level, but it's very much the same things. Like, you don't have to do it, but you can see they've really put in some very clever level designs to get to that point to give you something to do.
There's actually a reason for that, Greg, and it's that it's been in there since the original Wario Land game. There were some of the people that worked on the Metroid games worked on the early Wario Land games. So there is that.
Yeah, isn't it like what the people that were in R&D 1, which was back when Gunpei Yokoi ran it, that's what it was called. Didn't they go to become Intelligent Systems?
I think so.
Who then did Wario Land games, and they've gone on to make WarioWare and things like that, and they made Metroid Fusion as well. So they certainly do have that. But and of course, this is a totally different company from that, but they're channeling that spirit.
Yes,
and that's why I think that's why it's so successful as a sort of with them at the helm for the franchise. Well, here's an interesting. Why would you consider Metroid Prime in the sort of outsourcing classification?
When I was coming up with this feature, I was thinking about the same thing. I would say yes, it's outsourcing. Yeah. By and large, they're handing it to a new team. I mean,
yeah, it's In a way, yes, but in a way, it feels almost like it's a new franchise using an old story system, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess the point, that I think it's sufficiently embedded in Metroid to say that, you know, it very much is handing the franchise off rather than giving someone a new one. Because the gameplay is rooted in it. Obviously, the character, the world, you know, the sort of art design and stuff is very much rooted in it. So I'd still say, you know, you were dealing with handing something off there, something you know, quite cherished by many people, and obviously they did a fantastic job. But in close cooperation with Nintendo, which I guess is something we'll be coming back to a bit later on.
But the sequel, not so much.
an intriguing example, I would say, just by the fact that it's Brawl, because that was basically outsourced, wasn't it? They created this purpose-built team with people from Game Arts and Sakurai and all that. You know, there was no real... It wasn't internal, really. Well, of course, the previous two were developed by HAL,
but they were Sakurai.
So it's kind of a bit. It's a bit what in the sense that you've got Sakurai is the common factor, but he's not actually with his team anymore. He's got a new team, which is completely different and from an external source. It's not from any of Nintendo's other internal teams.
And this is a little bit inside baseball, this conversation, but it is in a way it's sort of like that. In a way, it's not, because really, these Nintendo teams really are, each of them kind of has their figurehead leader that's sort of in charge of them. So it would almost be like if they gave it to HAL to make Smash Brothers, it would almost be almost the same situation, because it's new leadership and a new development team just with the same name.
But the intriguing thing about Brawl is just goes to show that as big a release as that is, as bankable as it was and all that, you know, Nintendo were quite happy to outsource it in a sense, but they were also sort of staying close to home in another sense, because they kept Sakurai on board. All right, well, I guess we'll go switch to the obvious sort of converse case, which is when this goes badly.
Squeak Squad.
Excellent choice. Excellent choice. I reviewed
every WarioWare WarioWare. Let's see, what was it?
Wario Master of Disguise was my pick. Developed by Suzak.
I'm going to give Master of Disguise credit for having an interesting premise. But that could have been interesting.
Yes, but
it wasn't. But it could have been.
The way they executed it, it was clear that Suzak wasn't sure whether they wanted to make a Wario Land game or a WarioWare game. And, I mean, there are these mini games that feel like really shoddy knockoffs of WarioWare mini games.
And
you have to do that to do anything. Like, if you want, like, a treasure or whatever, all of a sudden you have to play this stupid mini game that isn't any fun whatsoever. And you play these same five mini games over and over again. Of course, the main game isn't any better either, because there's no butt stomp. It just doesn't feel like a Wario game. And you're drawing things on your touchscreen, but that doesn't work very well. The gesture controls are pretty bad in the game. So this pacing is completely different from a Wario game. The controls are completely different from a Wario game. The attitude doesn't know what it wants to be. It looks like a platformer, but it kind of feels like WarioWare. It didn't know what it wanted to be. I mean, and compare that with something like Canvas Curse, where they change the controls a lot. You know, it uses gesture or touchscreen controls. But it does kind of feel like a Kirby game in terms of the type of exploration, the power-ups. Master of Disguise didn't have that kind of...
Here's the thing, though. I feel like some of that isn't Suzak's fault, because I don't feel like Nintendo really knew what they wanted to do with the
Wario.
That's an
intriguing point. Yes, I think we'll definitely be coming onto that shortly when we get... But just to finish off sort of these examples of... Suzak actually developed some of those GBA F-Zero titles we were talking about earlier well. So they were kind of go-to, again, sort of like flagship,
Well, here's the funny thing.
Not in such a good way. They kind of made a living for a while.
Do you know who was involved in the development of Kirby Squeak Squad?
No, I'm not so sure about Squeak Squad. Exactly.
Well, Natsume was involved in this development. HAL was actually the publisher.
HAL
published it, I guess, in some ways. But apparently, according to one site, Flagship was involved in its development.
Yes, that's true. I remember that.
Yeah,
that was what really disappointed me. They did. There must have been a lot of internal problems, because.
Well, it looks like it might have been. Flagship got shut down around the same time they were finishing up the game.
Yeah, I think that might have been part of the reason. Maybe it was released before it was ready or something. I don't know, but.
Right.
Or it looks like it might have changed hands during the development process simply because Flagship was being phased.
Yeah, that's quite possible.
Apparently Natsume was also involved in its development, which they're
really
best known for their Harvest Moon games.
Harvest Moon, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Squeak Squad was obviously very different from Canvas Curse because it was a traditional Kirby platform game again. And what areas would you say sort of failed to live up to that heritage, Kiwapi?
Squeak Squad? The level design, I mean, even for a Kirby game, which usually has pretty simple level design, this one felt very, very, very linear. There wasn't any real exploration. There didn't seem like there was that much variety between like the enemies. I don't even remember any of the boss battles. I mean, it seemed like they were all about the Squeak Squad.
And of course, the flagship developed Amazing Mirror that we'd already talked about. That was kind of like a Metroidvania type sort of structure, right? And so this is just far simpler than that.
Oh yeah, this is very linear and very boring.
Yeah, and it feels sort of like Kirby done on the cheap.
Yeah.
It lacks some of the polish and execution that we would like from the franchise. It's got some weak mini games in there too. They don't really make a lot of sense. And there's like some touchscreen use. It doesn't really seem to have a purpose.
I think like you can mix powers in your belly or something.
It's only there so they could check the little tick box.
Yeah, exactly.
Touchscreen check.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, so that's a pretty interesting example. I guess the really sort of the real flip side, the other side of the coin here, is Star Fox Assault, because
mine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I didn't play it. I'm just thinking about it from the point of view of, you know, the whole like the Triforce partnership between Nintendo, Sega, Namco, and of course some of that involved Sega producing F-Zero X, GX, and AX.
It gave us Namco trying to make an on-foot game.
Yeah. James, what about how? I mean, obviously, I read the reviews and stuff. I thought for me as much as I.
Well, how long have you got?
We'll try so and keep it down, but I mean, encapsulate where it really failed.
Okay. Well, we've all played the N64 version, right?
And yes.
That had Landmaster stuff, right? And that it was a good diversion, I thought, in the N64 version.
It had that sub, which was kind of eh.
The sub was
It was one level.
One level, and it was an optional level, but it was, you know, it was probably the weakest part of the game.
Okay, and no, it wasn't the weakest part of the game. Do you remember the multiplayer when I think it was an unlockable?
Yeah, it was unlockable.
Yeah, yeah.
And you could walk around on foot. And you could fire rocket launchers. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah.
That was by far the worst part of the game.
Yeah,
like,
the worst part of a tiny
part of the game. Yeah. Okay, imagine whole levels based upon that idea.
Yep.
I do remember promotional material where you could like walk out on the wing of your R-Wing and fire.
That's right.
Why would you want to? You're in an R-Wing. You have a neutron bomb on board.
No. Just step out and whip out your sniper rifle. That's much better.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, I mean, I guess this falls into the conceptual fudge category of Warrior Master of Disguise, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It doesn't know what it was.
Everything felt just weak sauce. As James Jones said,
there's a real irony about that, considering that there was the people from Namco's Project Aces team.
It was not the Project Aces team, but it was a team that had just finished Ace Combat.
Oh, okay, so it was just another one of Namco's teams.
Namco at the time had two teams of today's combat games, a good team and a not as good team.
But one would think just from that, the brief would be, well, obviously this is about aerial combat because that's
right,
where we're drafting you in from, and yet somehow
not anymore.
It's about wing walking.
Confounding. I've been told that the three levels that are traditional Star Fox levels are actually pretty fun in that game. Is that true?
Very small amount, and right. it was okay.
Okay.
But it didn't feel as good as the N64 version. That's what I could never understand.
Could it be that you were still kind of bitter over everything else you had to play to get there?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, so if it had been standalone.
Another good one is like Star Fox Adventures. You remember the few levels that you're in the R-Wing? Like,
yeah.
It just didn't feel like a Star Fox game.
Right.
No.
They were there
and
because
at that
they
point,
had
I think
it was like that.
Because you were conditioned to run around with a stupid staff.
Yeah.
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 So imagine those bits.
With a dinosaur behind you.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It was just a whole mix of shit,
Star Fox
really.
Assault, the description we have kind of reminds me of kind of modern Sonic 3D games where there was some aspect of it that's good, but they water it down with all this crap no one wants.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, another good example of games to do that was the last Rogue Squad game.
Yeah?
Yeah, that had on foot parts as well.
That was terrible. So on foot. I remember getting stuck in that game because I couldn't get past this one terrible part where you had to like double jump over these things. I just couldn't do it.
Oh, yeah.
I just gave up because it was so shit. It was so shit. I just couldn't continue. I was like, why am I doing this?
So we've looked at some of the ones that have turned out pretty badly and therefore trying to draw some common threads between where it goes wrong. And I guess the first prominent one is this fact
on
that
foot missions.
Well, they don't know what they want to do, basically. Mm. You know, and I guess the first element that goes into that you have to think about is that perhaps Nintendo themselves have provided a sort of inadequate brief as to what the game should be.
Exactly. You know,
they haven't taken control of the situation and said, look, okay, you're developing this game, but you're developing this very specifically. You know, this is what we want it to achieve. And of course, you know, you have to also have like the as well as expressing the intent adequately, you then have to have the appropriate oversight and liaising
on the
development side to get that to happen.
I think another issue here is that if you look at it, a lot of times it may be that even if Nintendo gave the oversight, not only did they not give it, but they themselves might have been silently hoping that these developers come up with something for this franchise. Because in the case of the Kirby franchise, Nintendo really didn't have a clear agenda for that game. Because there's two or three games that really stand out in the Kirby franchise, and there's pretty remarkable differences between them. And then there's, you know, in the case of... What was the other ones we talked about?
Squeak Squad, Amazing Mirror.
Squeak Squad, yeah, but the Wario game. Nintendo really didn't know what they wanted to do with it, Wario Adventure.
I mean, you have to think that perhaps they, in that case, they sort of wanted them to sort of link it with WarioWare somehow. They wanted to, like, unify the franchise or something.
Maybe.
I don't know how you get to that point or perhaps that was something that Suzak came up with. And
we're
going to
make millions.
Let it slide.
Yeah. And then, or in the F-Zero games that were made by Suzak, you know, it was unclear if Nintendo wanted to do something with the anime, but the Suzak.
It was just kind of get a game out there to tie in with.
Yeah,
I think F-Zero is an interesting case because, in some cases, I think you look at some of these games and you say to yourself, well, you know, why are they being outsourced? And obviously, some of it is just that, you know, Nintendo has a lot of internal teams, but it doesn't have that many.
Right,
it's amassed so many. Great properties, and you know that they have to probably do a certain amount to actually continue these franchises on, or at least keep them current in some way. But I think in the case of F-Zero, I think they've just lost interest in it. You know, they haven't developed an F-Zero game since F-Zero X. You know, all the GBA games and then F-Zero GX, all developed by external people. And one might say the same thing about Star Fox.
Absolutely.
You know, that they still, you've got Command and Assault and
both,
Adventures
both
and
so
all
good.
That.
And you've
all
got...
not handled by them internally. And it just seems like, in this case, they're being outsourced basically because Nintendo thinks they can make money from the property, but has lost interest in developing it themselves.
Right, and I think that's a dangerous place for them to be in, because I think you do run the risk of harming the property irreparably.
Yeah, but also with Star Fox...
Like Star Fox.
The first Star Fox was, to some extent, already an external development team. It wasn't
I mean,
it was Western from the beginning, so... Nintendo, the only Star Fox game that Nintendo really made completely in EAD was the 64 game, which is the best one.
Yeah.
But
it was kind of like in reverse, wasn't it? They actually internalized Star Fox for a while.
It was done externally for the first two, and the one never saw release.
Yeah, the
and
one
then it was
wasn't
internalized
released.
Again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's quite intriguing, but it definitely seems like while they did that, they got the point being that at some point perhaps with some of these franchises, that's the only way we're going to get these franchises, because for whatever reason, the developers inside Nintendo are just not enthused about making them. I mean, another example we could cite is the forthcoming Punch-Out for Wii, because that's being developed by Next Level Games, who make Mario Strikers and stuff like that, not Nintendo. So again, it's like, people want a new Punch-Out, we can make some money off a new Punch-Out, but we don't want to make it.
so we're discussing why things are outsourced, but I mean, get back to the question, where does it fail? Because an outsourced game doesn't have to fail. We just talked about some that really did an excellent
job. Metroid Prime is a great example of one that didn't fail.
The thing that I don't understand, like something like Metroid Prime, like Miyamoto came in and he said, it's not working as a third-person shooter. Make it a first-person
shooter.
That's
the difference.
And they did it.
It's the direction from above, from someone who actually cares about the
franchise. Why didn't they do that with Star Fox? I mean, who the hell walked into Namco and said, yeah, that looks all right, keep doing that?
Because I think it means that Nintendo has to come in and make a proactive effort on these games because they're their franchises, and ultimately it's up to them to take care of them.
Yeah, they should. Why didn't they do that with Star Fox?
Well, that's kind of where I was going with this issue of losing interest, is that one of the issues is if they've lost interest in developing it to some extent, you have to wonder whether the passion's there to do their job on the liaison side and the oversight side.
Right.
Because, I mean, like I said, with Star Fox, we've seen that hasn't been that bang up. Now, with F-Zero GX, it turned out very well. The GBA games, not so warmly received. And I just think, you know, in some cases, a lot of it has to do with the developers themselves, you know,
we can say that that's not necessarily the case because of the flagship example.
Yeah, even flagships had good and bad experiences.
They produced what might be the most clearly amazing examples of outsourcing. And at the same time, they've produced one we point to as Kirby's Week Squad.
Yeah, but there's more to it than just direction. I mean, sometimes it's an issue of politics or something like that, where there's a lack of agreement on the roles and responsibilities. You know,
right.
Nintendo may be giving direction, but maybe the developer says, no, this is our game. We want to do this instead. And, you know, if they're not getting along, if there isn't a mutual respect and a mutual understanding from the get-go of what kind of game we want, who has the final say, you know, who has control over different aspects of the game.
Sure.
Then it can turn out, you know, really terribly, and I think that's where a lot of the games
go wrong. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, not to say that there aren't creative differences in game development under normal circumstances.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I'm sure there are, but it's an inherent danger in outsourcing a game because the kind of power structures and understandings that have kind of developed over a long period of time between an internal team don't apply necessarily when you're working with, you know, somebody that you haven't worked with before, and if it isn't sort of clearly defined what everyone's supposed to do or whatever, then there's room for that kind of ambiguity to cause problems. So again, I mean, it's something clearly that must be a bit of a danger with all outsourced sort of projects. And of course, as much as we laud Metroid Prime, it was a troubled project,
right? And
the final product was great, but you saw some of the problems just with how it juddled along very shakily for a long time.
Sure.
And I think that's part of an example of what you know, there was direction. It was and you could say that there was unclear of what Nintendo wanted to do with the project there too, much like there was with the Wario games. You know, it was unclear what the future really held for the Metroid franchise. So I think in this case, I mean, it had been a long time since one came out. They were taking it to a new direction, but they really didn't know what direction that was going to be.
Yeah.
And because there was involvement and people saying, this isn't working, this is working, let's do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've heard this before, is that Miyamoto holds a certain reverence for that franchise because it was Yokoi's franchise. And even though they did have that break in their relationship because of him leaving due to the whole fiasco of Virtual Boy, there's still
peace,
a lot of respect there.
Yeah, I mean the point, I think, as well, is that clearly Nintendo showed it cared about it because it had Intelligent Systems make Fusion. So,
sure.
You know, there wasn't this kind of, you know, indifference towards the Metroid series in general, which may have applied other. I mean, I guess another thing I think that's a problem that may apply to a lot of outsourced games is the issue of budget.
Absolutely.
That games lack polish, because the whole point of outsourcing it is basically to skimp on making the game, and therefore, regardless of how talented the specific developers you're outsourcing it to are, if you're not giving them the resources to work with, then they're probably not going to produce a particularly polished product. I mean, I think one example of this, and it's not a particularly bad game, but there's something about it that's just a little bit missing, is Yoshi's Island DS, which was developed by Artoon. And apparently Artoon actually pitched Nintendo on the idea of making a sequel to Yoshi's Island for the DS. Nintendo didn't sort of seek them out.
Right.
It was actually Artoon that sold them on the idea. And yeah, it's a pretty good game, and it got mostly good reviews. It's very, you know, conservative with the Yoshi's Island sort of template in general, which is another thing that can happen, I think, with outsource games. Obviously, they fear being too creative in some cases. Because they don't want to sort of upset the balance. But also, it just, you know, just little things like the sound effects or the soundtrack or, you know, certain aspects of the art design, it just felt like there wasn't the same layer of sheen that you would have expected if this was Nintendo developing it.
Yoshi looks slightly weird, right? That's what you want to say.
Yeah, there's just something a little different. It's trying to
your
be...
Your precious Yoshi.
It's more about like the sound is a very clear area to me where it kind of, you know, has the hallmarks of being sort of a bit shortchanged.
Oh well,
you know what I mean. And
yeah,
I couldn't be worse than the Wario Master of Disguise where I literally, it sounded like someone just like pounded out some notes on an electronic keyboard, and there you go, there's your music. And and the graphics
are radio trivia, by the way.
And the graphics honestly are less detailed than Wario Land 3 for Game Boy Color. So I mean,
no, I tell you what, though, I mean that, but that's the difference. See, I mean, you look at sort of like Wario Land 3; it's an 8-bit game, but there is really polish exuded in that game. Just like, you know, his sprite is very expressively animated for something that is obviously pretty crude, you know, and that's the kind of thing that comes through with when you've got that kind of, you know, the care and attention paid when, you know, it's the people that are, you know, that care about the game itself, and that is missing in some, and of course, I mean, it isn't in others, and I guess budget is a part of that. Like, for instance, I'm sure the team making Brawl didn't lack for money.
And sometimes it's also the technology behind it too, and maybe that's not so much true for some of the games we're talking about, but in some games, they're using a different engine for this sequel or spinoff than they're using for the prior games. And I don't know if it's an issue of not feeling comfortable giving the third party their engine, or if it's that the third party feels more comfortable using something they've used before. But sometimes, you know, especially with like first-person shooter games where you see this sort of spinoff aspect of it, you know, what was it, like Big Red 1 or whatever, you see... maybe that's not a good example. I don't know. I'm so bad with FPSs. But the point is, sometimes there's some games where it's trying to kind of recreate it, but it's using a different engine, so the controls just feel slightly off. And the graphics maybe aren't as good.
That's a problem where it's kind of like a reverse engineering kind of thing going on.
Yeah.
And stuff gets lost in translation as a result. Just as we transition towards the end, I want to say, looking more at the upsides of outsourcing, we kind of talked about how and why it kind of goes wrong. But I mean, I think the first we've already touched upon is just the fact that you get games that you wouldn't otherwise get, basically.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think F-Zero GX does not exist unless there's somebody willing to make it outside of Nintendo.
And right. I think F-Zero GX is another good example, because I don't see Nintendo had a whole lot of involvement in that game, but it worked because the team Nintendo gave it to already had experience making racing games from that over-the-shoulder perspective. And they gave it to
and they had experience with the hardware as well.
Yeah. And they had experience making games that were fast. And they gave it to a team that was able to take the franchise and take it to another level because they had that expertise that Nintendo probably didn't have.
Well, yeah, that is a very good point, because in fact, sometimes when you go outside, maybe you bring in additional expertise that you didn't have. For instance, in the Metroid Prime example, now it was Miyamoto that ultimately sort of declared that it would be a first-person game, but Retro was formed from people that came over from Iguana Entertainment.
Oh, don't tell me that.
No, that's
that
true.
Sounds terrible when you say that.
That's Spangenberg and all that. They were from Iguana, the guys that did Turok, and therefore they had first-person experience in game development. And I'm sure that actually, you know, who else inside Nintendo would have been able to produce
a
first-person game? Because they've got no experience of it whatsoever. So while it was all well and good for Miyamoto to have the idea to execute it, they had people from outside that had that kind of knowledge. So that, again, is definitely some of the benefits of outsourcing that I see. You could get that kind of, you know, the creative input from the outside.
Right.
Which I think could be
valuable. And I think another benefit is, in the case of, like, Flagship, you get people who want to do something different with the franchise.
Yes.
It's not been done yet. And in the case of the Zelda games they made, I think the Minish Cap, they took a creative direction with the game that was different than what Nintendo was doing with the mainline franchise. And they went out and kind of did their own thing. And I think
it worked
pretty well.
How so? I thought Minish Cap was pretty conservative.
I mean, it had some interesting kind of like new, had a different kind of item set in some ways, in terms it had some items that weren't just like the ones that you've collected in like a lot of Zelda games, including Phantom Hourglass. Like, instead you had like stuff like the jar and the mitts and you know, but not anything that fundamentally different.
See, I think it just feels like it's a more game designed just to be pure fun versus less, you know, really hardcore adventure-y stuff they were getting ready to do in, you know, Twilight Princess.
Well, I mean, I think one of the big things, of course, as well, as there's with what Flagship did, Zelda's representative, is just that even if it's not about keeping the franchise alive per se, it does broaden it out in terms of you get, especially portables, you know.
Right.
Zelda on portables.
It kept it alive in the portable world.
F-Zero on portables, obviously. And I mean, another one I think that's quite interesting, I mean, I don't know how you stand on this about outsourcing, but Mario & Luigi series by Alpha Dream.
Oh, yeah.
So this is kind of like to go, obviously Mario & Luigi is kind of his own series, but at the same time it's very much like, you know, sort of a handheld take on the Paper Mario games, but different.
All right, I'm going to call foul on this one. I'm going to call foul on this one because the founders of Alpha Dream and many of the people working on it were actually highly involved
Mario RPG.
In Super Mario RPG.
It's a bit of a Sakurai kind of situation. Yeah.
Right.
They gave it over
to somebody who was already on it. Basically.
But perhaps with more right. But the good news is that Nintendo did make use of them in their sort of new, you know, their new capacity being free from Square Enix to
actually
bring it to
to
the GBA and keep it alive. And again, just that ability to do that, I think outsourcing is one of the main benefits of it, is that you can just, you know, broaden your portfolio and do things you otherwise wouldn't do.
Absolutely. And sometimes outsourcing works differently, but I really wanted to bring up Dragon Quest because it's kind of a unique situation where they have kind of a core team, oversight team, kind of like what we're talking about with Sakurai and Brawl, Armor Project. And then, but for a lot of the heavy lifting, they've used many different companies over the years.
Level 5, right? The guys that do Layton.
Right. Level 5 for the most recent ones. They started off with Chunsoft, which has, of course, since then done tons of Mystery Dungeon games. So, like, Dragon Quest 1, 2, and 3, I think, or whatever, were Chunsoft. But then they used Heartbeat, and Art Piazza, has done some of the remakes for the DS. So, I mean, they're able to, like, almost, like, use these developers as kind of really manpower almost and frankly
a supplemental force basically.
I mean, obviously with Square Enix a good example because they have such a kind of rigorous employment of their, you know, their franchise games with these, you know, this sort of, what do they call it, like polymorphic content or whatever, where they've got like 5 Final Fantasy 13s that they're going to do and all that. I mean, they have to do a lot of, you know, farming out to various developers. And I know you've got Toes did the GBA ports of the Final Fantasy games. Toes, who are the so-called ninja developer that go out and do stuff in secret, but we found out about that one. I mean, that's basically what they do. They kind of sort of do outsourcing on the down low, basically. It's like, if you want this thing made
whilst
not
killing
by
people
you,
in their sleep,
but you don't want people to find out, to go to Toes. That's kind of the, I guess, the thing there. We're gonna close the final question we've got these days is just, you know, which is interesting in terms of where we are now with the Wii and the kind of direction that Nintendo's internal teams are going, is should we have more or less outsourcing? Because,
well, is the same an option?
Well, same, certainly more option,
than that they're doing now, because like at the moment we've got nothing from Nintendo, so they really need to do more so we have more games to play.
If they're not, I mean, I guess some people would say, well, you know, if you know, for instance, Iguchi's team's going to be busy doing Animal Crossing, City Folk, and Wii Music, then, if they can't do anything, then, you know, give some more property to somebody else. You know, so, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, obviously, Nintendo is kind of going in a different direction.
Yeah. Well, what about with other companies, though? I mean, Nintendo is not the only company that's outsourcing.
Yeah, well, they're far from the only company.
I mean, Sega outsourced Super Monkey Ball Adventure or whatever, which is a good example of one where it's trying to kind of recreate, but it turns out really poorly.
Yeah, well, that was Traveler's Tales, I think, wasn't it? Yeah.
Well, they have a long history of they have a long history of making really bad outsourced stuff with Sega, including Sonic 3D Blast for the Genesis. So Sega's been doing this for a very long time. And they kind of did it with the Wii version of Sonic Unleashed.
What about the Sonic Advance games? How were they handled?
Those were great. Basically, Sonic Team handed it off to Dimps. I don't know how. I believe that Sonic Team did very little with that that series besides
that
maybe
sense.
Do some artwork.
Yeah.
And Dimps did a fantastic job with all three games. And
then went
DS
on
game.
To do Sonic Rush 2 as well, both Sonic Rushes.
I don't think they did the second Sonic Rush. I think that was a new...
Oh, yeah, the adventure one, I'm not sure about that. But that's the thing. So they've another sort of like flagship where they've had this kind of quite long relationship at this point on portables. And that seems to have gone pretty well, I guess. That is an argument one could make for outsourcing, is where kind of, you know, if the original creators had jumped the shark,
you might as well jump flaming sharks or something even greater.
Like, it can't get much lower, so why
flaming
not,
bears know? On sharks.
Yeah,
flaming tornado bear shark. I guess there's certainly arguments for more outsourcing, but it seems like, if the Kid Icarus thing is true and the punch, and obviously we know about Punch Out already, then it certainly seems like Nintendo are wholeheartedly embracing it right now.
But then why aren't they outsourcing Animal Crossing? Or did they, and they're doing it with Tosei, and they're not telling anyone?
No.
I
would hate to think that there's internal development team.
That team is doing a lot of stuff, so maybe
they
did.
If it is the same exact team doing both Animal Crossing and like the new Wii Sports,
Wii Sports Resort, and working at
Wii Music,
did something else. Too.
And then weren't they working on Wii? If that's true, and they were spreading themselves thin, I can see why Animal Crossing wasn't quite as good as it should have been for Wii. And in which case, that would have been a good argument for outsourcing that one. If they didn't really have the resources to do that game justice on their own, they really should have outsourced
it. Yeah, I mean, some of it is the intent, though. If they've simply intended for it to be a very conservative iteration from the beginning, then therefore that's maybe why they feel they can handle it at the same time.
Okay.
Whereas if they'd had more ambitious plans, well, then maybe they would have thought, well, we're going to have to decide between, you know, giving at least a project to someone else, whether it's Animal Crossing or not.
Well, I hope that they outsource F-Zero again, because I hope Miyamoto stops being a dick and lets Sega do it again.
If we get one, it needs to go there, but I don't know if we will. The sales were kind of disappointing.
Like I said, if we get one, it's almost certain to be outsourced, because I just don't see like there's any pedigree for Nintendo.
But it wasn't that he didn't like the game. I think it was the sales. I think the sales were just not good. Well, here's one for you. It was able to allow... We kind of mentioned this before, but... The outsourcing of the Zelda games kept the Zelda games alive on the handheld systems and led to Phantom Hourglass.
That was them sort of internalizing
but
the handheld
Zelda games again. I have a hard time thinking that if we hadn't kept the handheld Zelda games alive, we would have Phantom Hourglass right now. At least not as it is.
Yeah, but then again, you could also see Phantom Hourglass as something of a repudiation of the handheld ones that came before it, that it was about, let's reboot the handheld series, let's get the sales back going again, you know, and change it and all this, so...
Maybe, the game that sold really poorly for the Zelda franchise was Twilight Princess.
Yep.
It didn't sell gangbusters in Japan, and that is an issue. But I know I don't think they were particularly thrilled with the Minish Cap sales either, considering obviously GBA, you know, was a pretty big platform in general. So there's no reason why it shouldn't sell well.
Yeah.
Twilight Princess wasn't made for Japanese people. It was made for the States.
It was made for
people
who bitched about Wind Waker.
Sure.
And that all those people are terrible people, and I hope terrible things befall them.
Well,
I mean terrible things. I mean terrible, painful, life-ruining things.
And so with that, we're going to come to a close for this episode. This will be, almost certainly, barring unforeseen scheduling chicanery...
Oh, God.
The last episode of RFN of 2008.
Ever.
Ever.
Well, who knows? You know, if Johnny doesn't come back from the Dagobah system in time for next year, you don't
He's
know
still in training, you know?
He's frozen yeah, in exactly. carbonite.
No barrel roll!
So, yeah, this is it. This is it for 2008. It's been a good year of podcasting.
We've been here a solid year, haven't we now, Greg?
It's been pretty much us from the beginning of this year. And presumably we're going to be running right back into next year, but when Johnny will return.
And fires both of us.
Possibly.
It'll just be him and Lindemann being the hardcore gamers.
Hope you all had everyone listening had a wonderful Christmas and have a great New Year if you celebrate both of those.
Happy Hanukkah.
I hate the New Year.
Happy Kwanzaa.
Happy Kwanzaa from four white guys.
I'm very grateful for TYP coming on with us. It's been good having you back on the show.
It was good to be here.
Out sometime. I hope it won't take another 6 to 12 months to schedule something across 13 time zones or whatever, but it's entirely possible that could happen. And of course, the same applies to James Charlton. Great.
10 million polygons, never on a cartridge.
That's right. 13 time zones, never in a podcast, but can stop us.
And so, yeah, a lot went into generating this episode, so I hope you all enjoyed it, and we'll see you in the new year. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
See ya.